Armchair Sports Talk. Ken Holland, you don't have to go, but you just can't stay here.
Overcooked.
All right, you're listening to Armchair Sports Talk. I'm your host, Eric Dorsch. We've got in studio today, D.O. Poliro.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
We've got on the phone, Justin Marcus.
Hello.
And Russ Ivanek.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, guys. So we're going to lead off the way we seem to always lead these things off. So the Detroit Red Wings fall last night 6-3 to the Montreal Canadiens. For a brief moment there in our thread, we were discussing this, that we were very impressed with our Detroit Red Wings. They were looking good. They were looking like a quality team. And then in the blink of an eye, that changed. Guys, what is wrong with this Red Wings hockey team?
In a word, the defense. We keep giving up high-quality shot attempts. We let them cross the crease with pucks. And we had a goal last night where we had three defensemen sitting next to the goalie, and they didn't see the guy get the loose puck behind them all and put it in. I mean, we're struggling on defense. The power play is great. The power play is about the only thing that's consistently working. But everything else is so streaky up and down. So if Jimmy's not standing on his head, the defense isn't gonna stop enough from going in to really give us a chance to win.
All right, Paulie.
I've noticed a lot of the goals that are scored against us pretty much follow the same pattern of one shot is taken, and it's either saved and rebounded out, and our defensemen have their backs now to the opponent shooting on them, and their backs stay turned because then the rebound gets attempted again to get put in the net and again perhaps, but the whole time the defense are just standing there. And I don't know if that's just my anger bias talking or what, but it seems like we just don't want to watch the guys as they score on us.
Oh, we saw that a lot last night.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's how our 2-1 lead slipped right away, is a couple quick goals that were exactly like that.
Yeah, they let Andrew Shaw absolutely snipe, and I've got a problem with the creativity and the energy. I watch the Kings play, I watch the Blackhawks play and other teams as well, and they have energy, and outside of our power play, I don't see that on 5-on-5.
Okay, so I've got the box score here right now. Brandon Gallagher gets 2 goals on us last night. Again, the Andrew Shaw one, which how Andrew Shaw scores a goal is...
The power of the mustache.
Exactly. For the Red Wings, you know, Mantha lit the lamp, Tatar. It's just... It's again, I bring it up from last week. It really does seem, and Paul just said it too, it seems like this team struggles mightily with a lack of defensive talent. And I don't get the impression that we plan on fixing that anytime soon. Jay, what do you think?
I agree. The other surprising thing for me is, even though we do lack in defense, Mike Green is still one of the point leaders on our team. So it's nice that he's contributing offensively, but we don't need that. We need guys to play defense. You see a lot of players get moved at the trade deadline. Shattenkirk from last year and other defensemen, they're the hot commodity. It's like the tight end of football. You need to have, or the tight end of hockey, rather. You need to have a guy on the blue line to actually be productive offensively and defensively. We don't have it. I don't even know what's in the minors that, you know, eventually could be called up to help. But, I mean, what? Cronwall, Erickson, that's not doing it. Jensen, I believe. I don't know what else is in the minors, but they need to fix it. I mean, if they want to succeed, they have to have a defensive core that actually works.
Well, you mentioned that, and I have the things here. Like, obviously, I don't know as many of these guys as well, but this Matt Puempel, left winger for them, 19 games played, 17 points. He's got 6 goals, 11 assists. Are you saying someone like that can't? The guy's almost averaging a point a game. You're saying he can't contribute up here, but we can, you know, hold on to guys who are probably not even averaging half a point a game?
See, what you're doing there is you're instilling logic into a situation that's illogical, because Ken Holland's not going to have him come up and play. You're 100% right. It would work, but...
Exactly. All right, so...
If he comes up, I'll give you $20.
You mentioned Matt Green being a point leader for us, or one of them. I mentioned this to Paul on the drive-in. Of all the categories that we monitor for leaders in, you know, goals, assists, points, shots on goals, all that stuff, for all those categories, we only have 2 people. Dylan Larkin and Anthony Mantha are leading every stat category for our team this year. Is that a sign of having two very talented players or just having a bunch of other guys that aren't really stepping up in areas we need them to? Paul?
What I like about those two in particular are that they're willing to take shots from anywhere, right? So, like, Anthony Mantha last night, for instance, he was basically behind the goal line, and he saw an opportunity to just throw the puck on and see what happens. And it was pretty close. I mean, it wasn't a golden scoring opportunity, but it was at least close enough. You know, and Dylan Larkin does that a lot, too. And one more thing I was going to chip in for, one thing I like about our offense is that Mike Green does what I kind of see in Victor Hedman for Tampa Bay do, is he actually comes in and pretends to be a forward, brings the puck in and gets some offense going. And, you know, the offense – another team was already watching our guys, our wingers, try to come in, but then all of a sudden that defender comes through and breaks through. And I like to see that happen because, you know, if we want to mimic any team right now, it's going to be Tampa to do that. So I appreciate Mike Green, Anthony Mantha, and Dylan Larkin very much.
Well, I mean, that's something we haven't seen since, in my opinion, Nick Lindstrom, a guy who's not afraid to bring the puck past where most defensemen will and try to get some offense going. I mean, and if you watch his highlight reel, a lot of his goals are him coming in to where a forward would be and throwing a shot on, and we don't have that very often. We've got guys that sit on the blue line, throw, you know, crappy slap shots at the goal and hope it works out for them. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But
I have a – oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I'm just trying to say that, to me, to answer the question, to me, I think it's more of a sign of us having two good players and then a bunch of guys who just aren't stepping up when we need them to step up. Jay?
I think it's a sign of mismanagement in a way. Interesting stat that I found is of the top five players being paid on the Red Wings, and it accounts for $25.4 million, the three people that Paul just listed, Mantha, Larkin, and Green, they are being more productive than the top five paid players on our team, which are Zetterberg, Tatar, Nyquist, Abbey, and Franz Nielsen. So you've got three guys getting paid significantly less, outworking the cream of the crop of our roster.
Yeah, but that's A, how you get paid, and B, how you make those other guys have to step up, because if they want their next contract to be remotely similar to what they have now, they've got to prove it. Because come contract time, it's sad to say, but Ken Holland is going to look at you and go, you are doing half what they're doing but demanding twice as much. You got to think Ken Holland's smart enough to know not to do that, but
yeah,
it's Ken Holland.
The problem with that, though, is these guys' next contract is 2021 and 2022.
I get that.
Zetterberg's locked up for four more years, making over $6 million.
Well, Zetterberg won't make it to the end of his contract.
Oh, I know. Well, probably not. But Tatar will at 26. He's got four more years at 5.3.
Yeah.
DeKaiser at 27 will five more years at $5 million, and they're getting outplayed. They're getting killed. It's not even close. Abbey, 4.25. For five more years. So, yeah, we'd like to see them earn their next contract, and if they don't, they're not going to get that, but we're already locked in for a while.
No, I completely agree. So, now moving on, I just mentioned his name, and I know we all have a lot to say about him. Ken Holland. Last night, to me, was another showing of why Ken Holland cannot be here anymore. He has done nothing to improve this team. It just seems like he can see the gaping holes and just doesn't really seem to want to patch them. He just kind of wants to wait and see how far he can sink this before he jumps off. And I just got to ask, guys, Ken Holland, what's going on here?
All right, I'll definitely start it off. I agree with what you're saying, too. And the thing that kind of triggered this revelation to me is I was looking at the Red Wings Instagram account, and they showed the lineup, and they had – David Booth spotted in as a number one wideout for the day, and it absolutely set me off. On the surface level, he's respected across the league, but he's got issues that he has to solve, and I've looked into them. Over the past decade in his career, and starting from 2008 when we last won the Stanley Cup, Holland has made 22 moves in players, picks, and future considerations to better the team at the trade deadline. Of those 22, only 8 of those moves are still within the Red Wings organization. And kind of as a side note, I'm not really looking at free agency pickups. You know, those players are either guys that have outstayed their contract with other teams, or they're too good and they want to get paid elsewhere. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about him making moves to either free up cap space or to become a better team. So only 8 players of the 22 moves over the past decade are still on the team. And of the 8, only 2 of them are actively playing to help out this team. Do you guys want to take any guesses on who those 2 people are?
I couldn't guess. Even if you gave me 100 guesses, I probably wouldn't be able to do it.
I'm going
to
guess Wilson on the 4th line is one of them.
Yep.
Yeah. We just traded.
Is Mike Green the other one?
Nope.
No, he was free agent pickup.
No. Yeah, well, the other dude is going to be Xavier Alouette. Or Alouette. I can't pronounce his last name. I always butcher it.
Yeah, Xavier Alouette. Okay, gotcha.
So, the 2 guys that are on our team from all the activity from Holland in 2 years is a 3rd-line D-man and a 4th-line O-man. That's it. Everything else, Thomas McCullum, second-time-around goaltender in Grand Rapids. He'll be an AHL lifer, so he'll never make his day up unless there's an injury. And then you got a slew of 19, 21, 18-year-olds that are playing in either the collegiate level, GR, the WHL, the OHL, and the ECHL. So 10 years, and I understand time is a factor, but over 10 years, you've got 2 guys on our team. And as of today, they played 43 games, and they have a combined 4 points. I think it's very damning on Ken Holland that that's what we're given. I don't know what your guys' thoughts are, but I think that's terrible.
Well, I want to bring up, what did we really give up in those trades, though? I mean, some of them will give up earlier round picks. Infamously, the Quincy pick where we gave up a first-rounder for him. But it's not like we're giving away the farm here. He might not be making us better, but at least he's not Peter Chiarelli in Edmonton actively making other teams better with his trades.
No, I agree with that too. That was I wasn't gonna form it that way. Russ is smarter than I am, but it's true. Like we really have. It's not like we're trading away Pavel Datsyuk for Ouellette. Like we didn't really give up anything that damned us in any way. Hurt us in any which way. But yeah, and I guess Jay, to counter that, while we're not a winning team right now and we don't seem to, you know, be there anytime soon, do we at least give him credit for the young talent he has seemed to find so far? I mean, Tatar, Nyquist, Mantha, Anthony Seau, Larkin. I mean, there's got to be at least some upside to what he's doing, even though not all decisions are great. He's clearly made a couple good decisions because he's at least got us a young offensive core that could contribute very greatly over the next couple years.
Yeah, to an extent, sure. Yeah, I'll give him that. But, you know, it's the slow progression that bothers me, I guess. So if he has a philosophy that we're never going to be drafting high enough to get talent to plug and play immediately, and if we're just stuck in this purgatory of being in the middle and we're going to get picks, and players, send them to the minors, overdevelop them, and then bring them up. Yeah, I mean, he had a quote that I read last night that he likes the incremental progression for Larkin and Mantha. And maybe it's just our generation where the, you know, give me now, instant gratification. I don't like the word incremental progression. I don't want my GM incrementally doing his job. I want him actively doing his job. That is the best case scenario for the team. So I'll give him credit for the minor league, but you know, bring it to the NHL level. Give me something better than David Booth on the first line. I think that's embarrassing.
Well, to speak to that though, the gimme now thing, I don't think we're that generation. I think we're the worst generation. We're the generation that spent our entire lives watching this team be a dominant hockey team, a team that was in the playoffs every year, was a cup contender for 75% of those years. We're so not used to our team losing the way they're losing that I think it's more of a, you were able to do it before, why can't you do it now? And it's on the reverse.
Right.
If next season the Detroit Lions went on a 20-year run of always making the playoffs, being Super Bowl contenders, I think it would be the reverse. We wouldn't know how to handle ourselves. We wouldn't know how to handle the Lions consistently winning football games. It's that accustomed. And we're not accustomed to the Red Wings being what they are, so we don't know how to handle it. And I don't. That's why I say it. It's not a gimme thing. It's more of a, why can't you do what you did successfully for the last 20 plus years?
All right, we're spoiled. We're absolutely spoiled.
I agree.
I mean, we had the 25-year streak. I mean, and that started in 1990. Holland took over GM in 97, so he's presided over the majority of that streak. So at the at the beginning of that, there was more cups than there's been in the last 10 years, obviously. But that's a level of consistency that's rarely been matched in the league ever. So if you want more, he's lacking a little bit in that recently. But if you're looking over a longer time span, we have absolutely been spoiled by the success of this team.
That's very true. But to counter it, Holland said something at the beginning of the season that's still stuck in my head, and I wanted to bring it up. Before the season started, he said that they are a team hunting for a playoff berth, and they're hoping to perform better as the season progresses. And instantly in my head, all I heard was that he's just hoping to stumble across enough wins to appear that we're good enough so people will come down to the new arena. And hunting for a playoff berth, that's what everyone's doing. Like, that's the whole point of the NHL. I get in my car and I hope not to get into a car accident like everyone else in the world. So I get that we used to be so good and we might be spoiled, but like in the here and now, that's his benchmark when he makes those comments. Like, oh, we're just hoping for a playoff berth. It's like, no, go back to 89. Go back to the back-to-back Stanley Cup champions. Like, that is the benchmark, not just making a playoff berth.
So what would you have wanted him to say in that case?
I want him to say we're trying to win the Stanley Cup. I want him to say that he's doing the best that he can. Like, he needs to prove it to me, and I feel like he needs to prove it to the rest of the state that he's actively, trying to win the Cup. And I know that's like kind of a rhetorical question or a statement because, of course, everyone's doing it. But when his benchmark is, oh, we're looking for a playoff berth and we just want to get better, it's a vanilla statement. He doesn't want to step into anything, but, like, that's not what we expect around here. We expect Stanley Cup champions. At least I think that we should. To some degree.
All right. I just wanted to say to that, our goal is to make, playoffs. That's where we want to go with this. It's a common statement that you hear all of these athletes make. It's title or bust. It doesn't matter if we lose to use baseball. It doesn't matter if we lose in the ninth inning of the seventh game on the last pitch. If we didn't win the title that year, it's a bust. It's a bust season. So, I think that's strictly Ken Holland, because there's no way Zetterberg's going, oh, yeah, if we make the playoffs, this is a great year for us, because that's not the case at all. But the problem with that statement is, if that is a team mentality, okay, you make the playoffs. Well, you've just gotten to your goal that's been driving you all year. You have nothing to drive you in the playoffs. Your goal has to every year be, if we're not hoisting that cup, we were the worst team in hockey. Even if you like won the regular season stats, if you filled it completely, you didn't win that cup, you were the worst team in the league. And
so you're not happy just being the Washington Capitals, winning the President's Trophy and then getting beat by the Penguins again?
Exactly. But I mean, it's true, though. Because, I mean, we've all played sports. If you don't win the title at the end of the year, it's not a successful year. I mean, I scored 50 goals and 30 assists. Like, I had an amazing year. Who gives a crap? Someone else who did half those stats is holding a Stanley Cup above their head right now.
Right.
I'll take the title over the individual accolation any day of the week, and I think almost every athlete in the world would agree with me on that.
And I think Holland actually agrees with you, too. I think that quote is him trying to manage expectations, because he's looked around. He knows this isn't the teams that he put together before. This isn't 2002. This isn't 2008. So he's trying to take it day by day, because rebuilding without tanking is an ugly process, and it's not always successful. So I think this is a bit of hot air that he's throwing at the fans as a way to try to manage expectations.
Okay, but to that point, what does that say about our GM that he's managing expectations? So in his head, he knows this isn't a very good hockey team I've put together. So what does that say to those guys in that locker room? Our GM, the man who is responsible for putting this team in place the way it is, doesn't think he did a very good job. So the mentality in the locker room can't be...
He found something positive to say, that, hey, we're going to go after the playoffs, and not, hey, guys, see you next year. This is going to suck.
Yeah, but that's, in my opinion, yes, he tried to find the positive, but he found the worst positive you could have. The Philadelphia 76ers for the last 10 years have been the worst basketball team in the NBA. Like, they've come close to breaking records. But every single season at the start of the year, they would ask Joel Embiid, or they would ask the head coach, or they'd ask, you know, Nick Stauskas, the shooting guard. So what's the expectations for this year? And every year, straight face, title or bust.
Oh,
title
right.
or bust. And but that's
and
what
that
I'm
cost,
saying. You can't.
And that cost the last GM his job, not managing those expectations right. I'm not saying I agree with it necessarily, but I think that's what he's trying to do, is keep his job.
Well, I'm sure he is, but I feel like that's a glaring, you know, point on him. That what's that say that our GM isn't giving the generic title or bust answer because he doesn't believe we're even remotely capable of winning a title? It's got to be the GM is the not really the face of the franchise, but he's the captain of the franchise. He's the one that's moving it along, keeping it going. And right. if he's not optimistic and reaching for that, you know, that unattainable goal or that top goal, then I don't see how anyone else in that franchise can be even remotely capable of doing it.
I feel like it's like if the Pittsburgh Penguins GM came out and said, oh, we're just hoping to contend and get into the playoffs after going back-to-back, he would get destroyed.
Oh, that's
year.
A completely different situation, though. They just won
right.
two cups.
Right, but when you look at the history of the Red Wings, and you were talking about how they've been great and they've been sustainable over this mm-hmm. period of time, it's just like, all right, well, that's the benchmark. So why, if he wants to manage expectations and lower what I think I should expect from my team, he needs to be a little more transparent then, because the ticket sales don't tell you the same. The ticket sales have mm-hmm. gone up. The building's expensive. They got bills to pay. And when the prices go up and the seat quantity goes down, and then they're still trying to fill the seats, which they're not doing a good job at, even though that they're paid for seats. It's just like, I'd rather the team be transparent, and maybe that's wanting too much from, you know, a sports business, but, you know, when that's his opening statement, it doesn't sit in the right spot with me. And then he goes after Mantha publicly, even though he's leading the team in points, and you've got Zetterberg, he's got 4 goals on the year. It's just, I don't see managerial consistency out of him, and maybe he's just trying to save face or set expectations in a way. But just the guy rubs me the wrong way, and I think it's time for a new person to sit in that chair.
So I don't want to assume too much from a title, but Justin, didn't you share with us just yesterday that he had some quote about basically just saying that the players just need to play better? Didn't he just throw all the blame on them, basically?
Yeah, he said that Mantha was being a passenger. It's like, how is your leading scorer on your team a passenger? Zetterberg's the passenger.
That's a good point.
He's got 4 goals.
Absolutely. And one thing I was going to say, too, is that, you know, you have Ken Holland, who is revered as, like, you know, one of the better GMs in the league. And I keep sticking to the fact that I feel like he can't adapt to this ever-changing league, because you have, and granted, this guy had a clean slate to work with, but George McPhee of the Golden Knights come in, and that brand spanking new team's already a playoff contender already. They're looking to shape up to be that. And mm-hmm. so what is he doing or not doing that Ken Holland is doing or is not doing?
Well, if I can jump in, you want to know what other teams have been doing over the past decade? Because I got it here for you.
Bring it.
Montreal Canadiens. Montreal Canadiens had the second best record in 2008 when we won the Cup. Since then, they've had 3 GMs. Okay, fine. A lot of turnover, a lot of change. People want to jump in and make moves to make their mark. Fine. Over that span, they've gotten the likes of Alex Tanguay, 41 points in 50 games, Robert Lang, 30 in 50 games, and Scott Gomez, 108 points in 196 games. They've also gotten the likes of Drouin and Weber during that time. Currently, 11 players from 116 transactions are within the organization, and they've got 2 picks in 2018. So I picked a team. They haven't won the Cup. They had the second best record in 2008. And over 10 years, they've got more players and have done more, and they've got more big names contributing than what the Wings have done. And conversely to that, my second case, just real quick, Pittsburgh Penguins, yeah. Obviously. They've been the best team in the league for 2 years. They've had 2 GMs since 2008. They've had the likes of Chris Kunitz, James Neal, Patrick Hornquist, Bill Kessel, Bill Guerin, and Jerome Iginla on their roster, hoping to make some kind of push into the playoffs or win a title, which they did. And currently, 13 players on their team in only 92 trades, and they also had 2 picks in 2018. So comparatively, he's doing less. He's retaining less. And he's got less picks for the future, and we don't have any cups since then.
Can anyone speak to those rumors about how players are kind of admitting their unwillingness to come play for the Red Wings, whether it be when we had Babcock or because of who our GM is, or have you guys looked into any like legitimate information about that?
Well, I think what Justin just said about the blaring point that he's not willing to go out and get the players he needs to get to make this team win says to why, you know, players like Phil Kessel, Patrick Kane, Shea Weber, PK Subban wouldn't want to come here anyway, because okay, you're going to get me and you're going to consider that good. I'm not going to go out and get anyone else. And for any player that wants to win a cup, hearing you got to do it by yourself, the athlete in you may say, okay, I'm up for that challenge. But after a year or two of doing that, you know you need help. Everyone needs help. And I think
the rumors are somewhat true, though. There's got to be some merit behind it, because look at the quality of players we did get. Jordan Tutu, Kyle Quincy, what's his name? The guy I hated a lot. Steve Ott, Aaron Downey. Alfredson for like
Alfredson,
a season and a half.
Steven Weiss, like who should have been a good one, and would he play all of 10 games for us? I feel like,
and
I
we're
song.
Still paying for Steven Weiss's contract.
Well,
$2.5 million a year.
What's his name? Detroit's own Madonna. He didn't come in here and do anything. Hurt. We have a tendency to get guys who are past their prime, but again, we're not getting the talent. We're getting the name, kind of with the Dwight Freeney signing. We're signing a big name that, like Justin said, is going to boost up ticket sales, because everybody wants to go see, you know, a boy who grew up in Livonia, who's a Detroit Red Wings player, like Madonna, with his name on the back of the wing wheel. And that's the bad thing. If you're signing talent, I would rather you sign some guy that no one's ever heard of but has the most upside you've ever seen than tell me that, oh my gosh, tomorrow Patrick Kane is going to be wearing a Red Wings jersey. That's fantastic. Uh-huh. But I want someone that's going to produce for us, not someone that is going to add up on jersey sales. It makes no sense.
I totally buy in that players didn't want to come here for either the Babcock reason or just the city maybe in general. I know that's kind of a cliche. But the other thing, and maybe Russ can speak on this, it's got to be money. Sometimes we're not winning the sweepstakes of Zach Parise, Ryan Suter, Shattenkirk because of money. We had zero cap space for the rest of the year. And again, I'll bring it up. Our top five players being paid on our team are not our top producers on the team. So we have a money contract length issue and popularity coach issue, and we can't attract anything. And then all our minors are in the farm team. So it's like we have nothing going in Ken Holland's favor for him to stay in his position.
I think we also kind of waste money on people too. Like we picked up, you know, Dylan McIlrath and then also Tangredi. Being why?
Depths in Grand Rapids, but they're making less than $750,000 each.
Oh, so is that all?
That's not the biggest sin we have.
No, it is. All right, sorry, go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, so, all right, I'm going to make two quick points, and then I'm going to pivot off this trying to defend Ken Holland thing, because it's proven harder and harder. First off, did you use the Canadians getting Shea Weber as a positive for something they've done?
I'll answer it this way. I will gladly take Shea Weber on this roster, but yes, I did include
it. I don't care what you say. Shea Weber is a positive. The guy is still a good defenseman. He may not be performing.
No.
Believe me, in the sweepstakes, Subban was the better of the two, but it still has to be a positive in that team's direction.
He's still a net positive for the team.
Absolutely.
But you gave up Subban. So if we're looking at an asset management point of view, that's a net loss. That's a trade I don't want to see my GM make. Right? We're actively getting worse because of that activity.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was, just nitpicking a little bit, Mike Green is making $6 million this year, so he is our second highest paid guy. So at least one of the top five. So, hey, 20%.
Okay.
Good job, Kenny.
See, that's why you handle our stats, Russ, because you're going to correct me when I'm salty and wrong. So,
but I mean, your point still stands, though. Four out of the top five aren't producing like they should be.
Exactly.
So which kind of brings me back over to the good guys' side. I'm done trying to defend them right now. It's just a little too hard. You guys kind of touched on it. We're not swinging for the fences anymore. We're not getting the big guys that we need to get. Remember when we got Hossa? You remember how excited you were? When's the last time we've done anything like that? I sat down with what's quickly becoming one of my favorite books. Rob Volman put out a book called Stat Shot, and in it they do a long-form essay on roster construction. Kevin Allen, in particular, looks at it and goes, over the last 10 years, the teams that have won the Cup, they have four things. They have a Norris-caliber defenseman. They have a superstar two-way center. They have a difference-making goalie. And they have a GM that can find a way to fit all of them under the cap with giving enough value to fill out the other four lines. We don't have a Norris-caliber D-man. We haven't had one since Lidstrom. I haven't seen Holland do anything to try and change that. We had a superstar two-way center in Datsyuk, but he got old and retired, and we wasted the rest of it after winning the 08 Cup. We haven't had a difference-making goalie in a while. I'll give him a little bit of a pass because Jimmy and Peter looked like for a time they might become that, but it didn't end up panning out. And the fourth one, I don't think I have to explain to you guys how we don't have that fourth one.
I mean, on that checklist, we are 0-4. I 100% agree. And it was scary. Exactly. What's scary, and I know I brought this up to Russ in the past just because his numbers are so mirroring. In reality, the last, I have to use air quotes here, no one can see it, but Paul, difference-making goaltender we've had was Osgood?
It depends on what year you're talking about, too, because we had this tradition going where one goalie would be good for a while, and then his understudy would become better than him. So, it'd be, you know, Hasek was really good. Then Osgood started to be on the rise. Then Osgood took over.
Yeah, we
then
had
Osgood
that
started to suck.
Sellback. Yeah,
then absolutely. Howard took over, or someone somewhere in the mix of that too. So right now it's too much back and forth with the same two goalies that we have.
Well, for a while there though, it looked like Jimmy was going to be a phenomenal goalie for us. In his early years, it was like, okay, we've got the goalie position pretty much solidified, and then I don't know what happened. Something clicked in him, and he just can't seem to do it on a consistent basis.
We also lost a lot of good defensemen too, so could also be part of our problem.
Sure. Well, that's what I said for years. Nick Cronwall looked like a pretty good hockey player for a long time. I don't think what anybody realized was he was playing next to the greatest defenseman, if not one of the greatest hockey players to ever play the game. No offense, but if I'm dribbling the ball down court and Jordan's next to me, I'm probably going to look a little better than I really am just because I've got him.
Oh, right. I think two guys that my mind grabs toward that would go off on that checklist, Brian Rafalski. I missed the crap out of him.
You took the words right on my mouth.
He was great.
Amazing defenseman. And then goalie-wise, I go back to Mike Vernon. I think that's the last time you had consistent net minding.
Listen,
Vernon was the man. And
Vernon was great for a year for us. Like, he wasn't like some phenomenal let's go.
What about when we had Hasek?
Yeah.
He's up there. I just go back to Mike Vernon smoking a stogie laying on the ice. That was you're a G.
Honestly,
you can stay in my net any day.
If you want to pit to that argument, I've said this to Russ before. Chris Osgood's numbers are actually almost mirrors of Patrick Waugh, who is widely considered the greatest goaltender of all time. So, if you ask me, he may not have looked pretty when he did it, but Osgood got us wins. Osgood got us cups. I mean, he got at least two, and was he on the 08 team?
That's a good question.
Osgood, yep. I think so, yeah.
He was a part of four Stanley Cups, and he was this, like, if not the starting goaltender in the 50-50 race with the other one for three of them. Because Vernon was our goalie for the first one in the
90s. The first one, 97.
But he took the second one. Osgood, it was Osgood in the second one. Hasek comes in 02, but Osgood still plays and plays well. 08, I know Jimmy was kind of in the early Jimmy, but Osgood was there and still played. So it's Osgood. Of the impact goalie, the last good one we had was either early Jimmy or Chris Osgood.
My favorite goalie is anyone who has punched Patrick Waugh in the face, to be honest.
So Chris Osgood, yeah.
Chris Osgood, Mike Vernon.
You just balanced Justin and I out entirely.
You know, one thing that I'm kind of putting together in my head right now, that drop you have of why are you the way you are, play it for me real quick, because I have an answer for you.
One second, I'm going to find that for you.
Why are you the way that you are?
The way I am is because a part of my happiness in my soul is still sitting on my bed from 2008, 2009. Game 7, we lose to Pittsburgh at home, and Maxime Talbot scores twice. I'm still
That's
sitting
terrible.
On my then... I'm still sitting next to my then-ex-girlfriend, just sad. I think ever since then, they haven't done anything constructive. I just went over the list with Holland and how he hasn't been constructed. And I'm still stuck in that moment. And that's why I am who I am. That's why.
Well, after hearing that, it's safe to say there's nothing good about that moment. And that sounds like a nightmare. And we're here for you.
Yeah, we're here for
you, buddy. I don't think your wife's going to be too happy that you're still stuck sad next to your ex-girlfriend.
Hey, everyone's got a pass. That's where I'm at. I'm cross-legged on my bed watching it on my crappy TV, watching my wings just suck the soul out of me, and it's trapped in some bottle back then. Maxime Talbot, 2 goals. I'll never forget it. He went to the KHL. He's gone. He's not even doing anything hockey relative anymore, but I will never forget his name in 2 goals, and that's why
what
I'm
salty. What are you talking about?
They haven't... Oh, I got to stop. I'll go on. I know.
All right, so just circling back, it's a far reach, but I want to bring it up because I feel like it may shine a little light for the Red Wings and give us a little shade of hope. In your little comments about Montreal and then later Pittsburgh, Justin, you brought up that Montreal had the second best record in 08 that year.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me, I feel like record can't play any factor into the playoffs because if you get in, you get in. And we've all seen in all the sports across, your record doesn't make too much of a difference. It's 7 games. It's a 7-game series. You got to win it. It doesn't matter if you were the last team to get in the playoffs or you were the, you know, league leader by 30 wins. I mean, the Giants defeated the undefeated New England Patriots, and the Giants limped in to a wild card spot. So I just feel like if this Red Wings team can get in the playoffs, it's at that point, it's anybody's game. It's, you know, obviously some teams are very favorable over others, but I mean, all it takes is one hot week and you're on to the next round or you win a Stanley Cup, you know?
Wait, right. So how can we say that? Which I do agree, it's anyone's game as soon as you get in. But how can you say that and then we're ripping Holland apart for saying that they're just trying to make the playoffs?
Oh no, I'm not saying that. That's why I said I'm trying to defend a little bit of Holland. What okay. I was trying to say is Justin pointed out that they had the second best record in that year. To me, that felt like just an extra stat because they didn't win the Stanley Cup, but at the same time, what difference does their record make? They weren't even in the Stanley Cup finals. So
right.
I'm saying
I know you're encouraging me to get a bottle of Crown and go through every other team and give you their numbers, right?
Yes, I am.
Go for it. But I can promise you that if you do that, in 75% of the championships, the two best teams from that year are not going to be the teams that were in the finals.
Well, and I'll save you a little bit of time on that. I looked back in the salary cap era for who's made it into the Cup Finals. There's only been 16 teams that have made it. There's only been 7 different teams that have won a Cup since the 05-06 season. Well, one of them. We've been to 2 of those finals. So we're in rare company there.
So what, Pittsburgh?
Yeah,
us.
But that's,
yeah, Pittsburgh's
that's
got
like
three,
when people
Chicago's
bring up
got 3. Kings have got 2, and then Carolina, Anaheim, us, and Boston.
Yeah,
got 1.
Okay, yeah. And Chicago, right? You said Chicago, right?
Yeah, Chicago's got 3. Yep.
Okay, yep.
I think we need to convince.
That's like,
go ahead.
That's like when we talk Michigan State. Oh, Michigan has done all this stuff, and oh, well, State's been dominant for 10 years. The history doesn't mean a damn thing to me anymore. These teams are only as good as their last performance, and Ken hasn't put on a performance since probably when I'm stuck on that bed.
But that's what I'm saying. They're only as good as their last performance. So anything from 10 years ago with a record, it doesn't really contribute a factor to that because, again, they had the second best record in the league and then had 3 GM turnovers in the next 10 years.
I can live with that. I think basically, though, it was basically trying to see what have other GMs done in a 10-year span. Oh, and I only know of one other person that could be more wrong than Ken Holland at their job, and it's the people who give me the weather every day.
And Pete Chiarelli in Edmonton.
Well, but that's what I'm trying to say.
I'll let him in.
None of us will ever argue that Holland phones it in 9 times out of 10 for like our team. So I just think we're in a bad way, and something tells me that these next couple podcasts are not going to have too much upbeat content.
No, they've lost 5 in a row. I don't even know who they got, but they can bring in the Yotes for all I care. I guarantee you Wedgwood's going to perform much better than the Wings will.
All right, so in the next week, we've got Montreal tomorrow at Montreal. We have Winnipeg come here on Tuesday, and we have St. Louis come here on Saturday. My question to you is, are we 3-0? Are we 0-3? Is this going to be a positive conversation next week, or are we looking at potentially more of the same?
See, I can't even give you a guess to that because I can't even tell you what a winnable game for us is anymore.
It's true, though.
I really don't.
Yeah. I'll be the optimistic one.
Okay.
We're a streaky team, right? And I mentioned it last time. We either win at least two in a row or we win none in a row. So I'm thinking we lose one more of those games, but then we rattle off a two-game win streak, and we'll go 2-1 out of that. We'll be stealing one of those games that we have no business winning.
Yeah.
They'll find a way, and they'll frustrate us because we'll see what they can do.
Well, I mean, I'm looking...
St. Louis on the road or home?
St. Louis and Winnipeg are both here.
They're both home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going 0-3. I don't think they win a single game.
Not see, the reason I say that...
Lose streak.
Well, the reason I say that is I think those games are the ones they need to win because the rest of December, to me, looks bad. Because we have to play Florida the following Monday. I'm okay there. But then we have to go Boston. Boston here, Toronto here. At New York Islanders, at Philadelphia, at Boston, at New Jersey, and then the Rangers come here on the 29th.
Well, I'll tell you,
could potentially be 0 in every game loss for me.
We have to start by winning tomorrow, and I can't even tell you how we're going to do tomorrow either because, you know, here we lose to Calgary horribly one time, like kind of like how we lost horribly to Montreal last night, and I don't know, can we come back and beat them as badly as they beat us like we did to Calgary? I don't even know. It's a coin flip with us.
Bold prediction. We win 3 games in the month of December. That's once to Boston, maybe the Isles, and then give me New Jersey. I mean, that's all I can confidently say. I can't put the over under at 3.5. I'll take the under. That's all we're gonna win.
Hey, I'll take the over for a sixer bet.
You got it, dude. Seriously.
All right.
I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Terrible. I forgot. It was faded. 2 days after the Rangers, Pittsburgh comes here.
You can go back to faded. That's an L.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not the over-under.
But I have to say, I really wanted to be the optimist here. I kind of agree with Justin, though. I think we snag one of the next three that we were discussing. I know Paul and I are Winnipeg boys, but I think we may be able to pull that one off.
I think so, too.
Okay. Florida, I think we beat. But looking at the rest of this, we're not going to – we may have an outside chance of beating Boston if they come here. But we're not going to beat Toronto. I don't think we beat the Islanders. I don't think we beat Philadelphia. And I know if we go to Boston, we lose. So I think 3, maybe 4. We may squeak one lucky one out. But 4 wins in the month on 11 games is a very realistic expectation.
If we can't beat a struggling Philadelphia team right now, I really don't even know what we're going to do about ourselves.
All right, Jay, what's your bet?
If they win more than 3 games in the month of December, I will come on this podcast in January and not say a single mean thing about my Detroit Red Wings, just for one episode. I'll just be nice the whole time.
I don't want that. I want the honesty.
Well, why?
I like the hatred, Justin.
Oh, you guys are just feeding into my hatred. I love it.
Yeah, I lost my Morton table sea salt the other day. You're all I have for salt.
All right.
Justin,
I'll fulfill it.
I read a study. The angrier you get about your hometown teams, the more hair you grow.
Okay. Now you've gotten fired up like that little cartoon dude from Inside Out.
So then maybe we can make a bet that you shave your head. Oh.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, maybe if I go back and do a study on when I started losing my hair, it was probably in 2008, sitting on my bed.
Yeah, it was probably that bad.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Rowe.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll be here until at least we're done.
Until at least we're done with this. Okay. Let's do week predictions here. We're going to do 1 week of the Red Wings, and we'll go from there. Montreal on Saturday. Win, lose, and if you want to guess the score, you can. Russ?
All right, so we go Montreal, St. Louis, and then
Montreal on Saturday, Winnipeg on Tuesday,
Winnipeg.
And St. Louis on Saturday. We're at Montreal, and then we're home for the other two.
Okay.
I think we tag Montreal back. We'll get them 2-1 on the power play winner.
Okay. Winnipeg?
Winnipeg, I think we win too. I'm trying to stick with that 2-1 prediction, and these are the only two of the three I can see us winning. So I think we'll beat Winnipeg in a high-scoring one. They've got a lot of good forwards there. I'll say 5-4.
And St. Louis?
St. Louis, we're going to get our teeth kicked in. Gonna go 6-1 Blues.
Okay. All right. So you got 2-1 for the week, and your predictions, Jay?
I have personally watched them lose to all of those teams at the Joe in my life on this planet, and they will lose every single game by 2 goals.
Every single one by 2 goals. Okay. And
that's efficient.
Pauly?
I'm thinking my best guess is that we will only beat Winnipeg, and it's probably going to be a close one, probably something like 3-2, 4-3. But then Montreal tomorrow, nah. And then St. Louis, also nah.
Yeah.
They're probably going to beat us pretty bad, maybe by at least 2 goals again.
Okay. I'm going to use Russ's reference here about getting our teeth kicked in. That's going to happen on consecutive Saturdays. We're going to lose like 5-2 to Montreal tomorrow. It's Montreal. I said it. They had 2 guys score double goals on us last night, and both of them have 10 plus goals on the season. We're going to lose. It's not going to be fun either. Winnipeg, Paul and I aren't playing them on NHL, so they don't really have a chance.
If you plug me in, maybe.
Yeah, if you plug us in, they're going to beat the Red Wings like 8-0. But because we're not doing that, I'm going to guess that it's a 2-1 win. We'll squeak something out. I made this prediction a while back that we'll get one early. We'll show you what 2.5 periods of struggle look like, and then we'll get lucky on a dump in or something. And for St. Louis, I kind of go with the same prediction. It's going to be like 6-3, 5-3, something like that. We're not on that level right now, so I could definitely see us going 1-2. I want to be optimistic, but I don't see it happening.
You guys are being too nice.
Somebody's got to be.
Yeah, someone's got to put a little ray of sunshine. Otherwise, this is just not good.
I mean, 1 win, 0 wins out of that stretch, it's not too much generosity.
No, yeah. No, it really isn't.
Realistically, it'll probably be 1, but I got to get ahead of you guys on some predictions somehow.
Absolutely, absolutely. And where is it? I have it here. Right now, we are in 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth place in the Atlantic. I don't even want to guess what we are in the actual Eastern Conference. Are we in trouble?
Well, define trouble. Are we in trouble to make the playoffs? Well, yeah, because we're on the outside looking in on a wild card spot. Are we in trouble for getting a top pick? Nope, that's looking pretty good.
Yeah, but we wouldn't know what to do with it even if we got it. So
yeah, maybe.
Trade it for Kyle Quincy.
That's where I differ. I think if we had a top three pick, it's foolproof. I mean, you know, we might screw it up, but I hope they tank. I hope they lose. If we get a top three pick, I would actually have hope instilled back within me that they could do something with it. So I hope they lose every game. I hope we're done.
Okay, all right.
That would be nice. Get Svechnikov's brother. Have the two of them up through the system.
GM Marcus. GM Marcus. The Red Wings The Red Wings have the third pick in the draft. Okay? We've said multiple times on here what the Red Wings need. What do you draft? It doesn't have to actually be a person. You can give us like the position and the type of player. What do you draft, and what do we all know Ken Holland will actually draft?
Let's do this. I would draft a defenseman over 6 feet tall to be on the blue line. Ken Holland would probably draft him a chicken sandwich and some half-cooked french fries.
But don't forget, he might holla at our ex-girlfriend, Kyle Quincy.
Exactly.
Ooh, well, yeah, take that back. He would go get Quincy back in that beard that he's got.
That's what I think. You're right. We need a defenseman, a bigger guy, someone who can, you know, we need someone that can control the blue line, make it tough on the other team. What he would draft is some speedy winger that we have no need for right now because we've got enough of those. I mean, we've got Darren Helm, who's the fastest guy in the NHL, but if you give him the puck, he falls over.
I'm being facetious, but obviously if we had a top three pick, if he screwed that up, he gets fired the next day. You can't really go wrong with the top three players that are scouted because those are the only names that anyone even knows and talks about. So I would hope he would nail that one, but...
All right, that's going to do it for us here on Armchair Sports Talk. We hope you enjoyed. Obviously, please leave comments. Let us know what you want to hear. We're excited to get some feedback. My thanks to Paul Rowe.
No problem.
Russ Ivanek.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Justin Marcus.
Have a good one.
All right, that's one small step for us, one giant leap back in Detroit sports broadcast.
What you've just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. May God have mercy on your soul.
Armchair Sports Talk. Bruce Willis was dead the whole time, just like our playoff hopes. Armchair Sports Talk with five times the emotion of Jim Caldwell. Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna kill my head. I got a bad case of loving you.
All right, this is Armchair Sports Talk. I'm your host, Eric Dorsch. We're joined again by D.O. Pauly Rowe.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
And, Pauly, the other week we discussed college football, football in general, and the recent epidemic of head injuries in the game. And you mentioned to me earlier that you found another study pertaining to that, and I'm just curious, what do you got for us?
All right, so this study, first of all, the title has a very long name, so bear with me. It's Effects of Career Duration, Concussion History, and Playing Position on White Matter Microstructure and Functional Neural Recruitment in Former College and Professional Football Athletes. This is a study by, this was just the first name listed on the study, Michael D. Clark et al. I believe that was probably the medical student involved in the study. And this was published in the Radiological Society of North America. And I believe this was also a study that the NFL and the NFLPA provided financial support for as well. Because, of course, they're very highly interested in the high rate of concussions in the league. So, as the title said, this study was looking into the effect of career duration, playing position on given their concussion history and who or what type of player basically had the worst end of things as far as concussions go. And so just a few things to kind of hit from the get-go or just a few definitions so you can kind of understand what I'm talking about. There's something called fractional anisotropy, and that is referring to basically the diffusion of or movement of particles. And what that is just how things can move across a particular membrane. And so things give like a zero if it's something that can move freely through, and like something like your cerebral spinal fluid, or a one if it's something that's not very allowing things to flow through like a fiber. So hopefully that makes sense. I'll be referring to it as FA just to make it easier. And another definition, blood oxygen level dependent, and you might hear me refer to it as BOLD. And that's just an indirect measure of neural activity based on the difference in image properties of oxygenated and deoxygenated blood seen on MRI. And so what this study was thinking, they posed the hypothesis that longer playing career would result in cumulative white matter damage and augment the effects of recurrent concussion on functional neural recruitment. So basically, the longer you play, the more damage your brain's going to be, is what they were thinking, which sounds intuitively, you know, makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
And then also, they were looking at the difference in position. So they kind of referred to it as either a speed position or non-speed position. So your speed position, which this may make sense, of course, you're going to have your offensive backs and people who are, you know, moving at high speed, obviously. And then the non-speed, you're looking at the linemen, who, of course, have quite frequent contacts with the other linemen in front of them. And so who did they recruit for this study? They had NFL players who had greater than 5 years of play between the ages of 55 to 65 years old. And they excluded kickers and punters, probably perhaps for obvious reasons. As you can think, these guys aren't getting smoked on the daily. And they also left out anyone who changed the number of reported concussions that they had, because these athletes were surveyed. So if they changed their answers between when they were initially surveyed, they just kind of threw out that data. And then also they had former college athletes, D1, who had greater than or equal to 3 years of play in college. So they looked at people who played just in college or college and also the pros. And so things that they looked at in the study, they wanted to take a look at just like their baseline neuropsychological testing. They wanted to see if there's any pre-existing deficits in their ability to think, to function, to focus, any mental task. They wanted to see if there was any underlying condition there. So they did neuropsychologic testing to see if that was basically a yes or a no. They also checked out their working memory. So they did this task where they were under low, moderate, or high testing. So the low would be on a computer screen, they would see a lowercase d or capital D, and they either had to hit yes if that was what they saw or no for everything else that was seen. Moderate was yes anytime the previous letter was a D from the one that they were currently looking at. And then high was they had to think back to two letters previous to the one that they're currently seeing and hit yes if a D was two previous to that. So they had to go through these three rounds of testing to kind of see how their brain was working and assess their memory. And so they also used what's called a functional MRI. And that basically you can see how the blood flow in the brain, where it's going in real time, to assess white matter integrity. So your white matter is going to be portions of the brain that you can see light up with blood flow, so you can tell which areas of the brain are more stressed or more, you know, highly active at the time, and where there could be a difference in functional efficiency or any compensatory activity given their current mental function. And so what did they find for career duration? Between the participants, there was no significant difference for neuropsychologic testing. And for the FA, as I referred to earlier, the college cohort high-frequency concussion group had a decreased FA compared to the low-frequency concussion group. So basically saying that the college athletes that were used in this study, or the individuals who played just college ball with zero to one concussions, had better white matter integrity in their brain compared to the group that had three or more concussions. And also the pro cohort, so the people who played both college and professional ball, they had a decreased FA for the low frequency group compared to the high frequency group, which was an interesting finding that I'll come back to a little bit later. And as far as career duration goes, they found no interaction between concussion history and career duration for accuracy or reaction time for the working memory task that they had to do with the low, moderate, and high functioning. And so for the bold fMRI, so looking at blood flow, they found no interaction between concussion history and career duration for how the blood flow to the certain areas in the brain may be affected as far as career duration goes. All right, so for playing position, neuropsychologic testing, they found no significant difference. For the FA, they found that the frontal white matter in the non-speed players, the high-frequency group of the non-speed players, so the concussions of three or greater, they had a decreased FA. And then the speed players had no significant difference between the low and high-frequency concussion groups. And the bold fMRI, for as far as playing position goes, no concussion history and playing position interaction. There was no interaction for accuracy and reaction time found on that. So just to hit up the high points of the study, because it was kind of lengthy, it was about 11 pages or so. There was no significant difference in white matter integrity and working memory related functional neural activation patterns. Regarding structural and functional imaging outcomes, both career duration and playing position were associated with the concussion history. And for college, the greater than three concussions group, the decreased FA was found in the brain areas of the corpus callosum and the superior longitudinal fasciculus. So you can look those words up if you need to figure out what those are. And the unexpected result that I was referring to earlier found in the pro group. The pro group with the multiple concussions of three or greater, the greater FA found in the group with the more concussions compared to the group with the 0-1 concussions was an interesting finding, because that was basically saying that the white matter integrity was greater in the group with more concussions, which was very unexpected. But they think that might be more of a reflection of the selection bias for the individuals they selected in favor of, you know, former professional players with a relatively high amount of brain reserve. So it may not be reflective of the population of these individuals as a whole, because these individuals may have been, they were selected because they were able to participate in the study, of course, but for the population that they would suspect to have the greatest mental deficits would be those who went through both college and football, exposing more concussions, yet these individuals that they used for the study were far more better off than they may have anticipated. So that was a very interesting finding.
All right, Paul. Well, from playing sports, I've experienced a concussion or two in my time. And the last time I was in the hospital, the doctor told me there's not really a definitive test to prove concussion. As you've said before, you look for the classic signs, nausea, you know, dizziness, all that stuff. So my question to you would be, in the upcoming future, has there been any advancement or, you know, test that's kind of on the track to prove definitively concussion over potential other injuries that would come with a big hit?
One study I saw just the other, or read just the other day, is that it came out of UCLA. They found that there are certain proteins that can be released in the blood from cells in the brain called astrocytes. And they found that these proteins are kind of consistently elevated with whatever they did to find it. They found that these particular proteins were elevated about an hour after the head injury ensued. So what these proteins will tell you from these particular cells is that there was some type of injury to the brain that occurred. So of course, if you saw the incident happen, say if you're the sports doc and you watch you know, some guy get, you know, drilled in the head by another player during a football game, and then he's exhibiting all the signs of a concussion, and then you do that blood test an hour later, confirm that he had a head injury, and you pretty much know it might be a concussion based off of how you diagnose a concussion anyway. Put two and two together, that might be your route to diagnosing it earlier with more certainty, because these, I can't remember the name of the proteins at the moment, but, you know, they're, of course, the highly scientific acronyms that they give things, but yeah, so I think this is a pretty exciting study to have, and I hope that this can be implemented one day and be readily available. You know, perhaps you see a concussion happen, get the guy to the sideline, and, you know, put up a tent, draw some blood from him, wait an hour, you know, after an hour's worth of time has gone by, and then see if you can find those things and, you know, just follow the proper concussion protocol after that. And that might lead to better outcomes after there.
All right, now, Paul, you mentioned earlier in this that they tested two different types of players. They tested the skill set players, receivers, running backs, defensive backs, and all that, and they tested more the linemen, the close quarter players. In the study, was there a finding in difference of effect in the way of the injury to the brain? Did they see something in skill players that they didn't see in linemen and vice versa?
So this is probably going to make a whole lot of sense for the way that you see these players participate in the game, and that is the offensive backs, their injuries for concussions are more so from the acceleration of their role in the game, and the linemen more so for their frequency for their role in the game. So, you know, the linemen, obviously, every play starts, they're going head-to-head with the linemen in front of them on the opposing team. So based off of how their roles differ in the game, you kind of get a different area of the brain perhaps that could be effective. So for instance, the linemen, basically literally going head to head with the guy in front of them, they have a lot more impact to the frontal lobe of their brain, and that's where the deficits were mostly concentrated. Whereas the speed players, the play goes in so many different directions that the initial way that they go about making the play or stopping the play is going to be pretty variable. So the way that their head could be impacted could change from one play to the next. So it's kind of hard to predict exactly how their head could be impacted on a regular basis.
Okay. And then we were discussing before we started all this, the possibility that the NFL and college and football in general may need to take a look again at the protective gear these players wear. Obviously, for the whole more frontal, you know, part of the head, if you're seeing a consistent thing of injury with those types of players, it would stand to reason that maybe they need to look into strengthening the helmet in that area or more padding or something. Is that something you need? Do you think they need to do, or is this more from a these injuries more an observation on the way the game's played, the physicality, and maybe dirty hits, cheap hits, and consistent hits just taking an effect regardless of how much you protect it?
So the study mentioned that too, and they brought that into question. For the linemen in particular, since the impact is so almost consistently towards the front of the helmet, you know, I'm no engineer, of course, in designing these helmets, but I think if they can design some type of padding or some type of structural change to the front of the helmet to kind of disperse the impact that they experience, because these guys hit hard, and especially for them having the frequency that they collide right from the hike, you know, they if they can design some type of, whether it be padding or some type of actual difference in the actual architecture of the helmet itself, you know, I think that would hopefully, you know, deplete, you know, and change all these the concussions that they're getting. So hopefully those numbers will get go down, because they're seeing a lot of these, you know, brain injuries so much later in life, you know, with the CTE that the people in their older ages are getting from all these concussions. You know, hopefully that would make a change for the better. And as far as the speed players go, with it being more of a variable impact on their head, you know, there's only so much room within that helmet, of course. So, you know, if you try to pad everything, there's not really much room for the head left, of course. So if there's a way for them to make an overall change, I think that would help both, you know, the speed players and non-speed players, that they can design helmets that are, you know, kind of like with the way they do buildings to survive earthquakes. If there's a way to kind of design it such that the force is distributed better, because I know that they did some work on helmets already, but there's a way for them to change that, you know, I think that would do a justice for everyone involved.
Now, see, what I find amazing, because I know you only played a year and all that, but we've both worn football helmets. We've both worn hockey helmets. What I don't understand is how a hockey helmet is satisfactory for protecting a human's head, yet we seem to have problems with a football helmet, because a hockey helmet is not much. It really, like, you know, we put those things on, there's not anywhere near as much padding and support in a hockey helmet as there is in a football helmet.
Right. And, you know, the helmets for hockey, it's kind of, no one really expects that the head-to-head collisions are going to really happen a lot in hockey. But, of course, that's where the hits come into play, because guys will get hit from behind and their heads go either careening into the glass, the boards, another player, or the ice, perhaps worst of all.
Or not to mention a 90-mile-an-hour slap shot banking off your head.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, you know, those helmets are definitely not built to withstand the types of, you know, because concussions obviously will happen in hockey. And as we talked about last time, only 8-9% of those are from fighting itself. So therefore, most of it's coming from the hits. So for hockey, I think you can only change so much about the helmet, because it's not really that instrumental to what the player is doing. It's more so just for protection. As far as for the helmet in football, you know, the way to tackle someone, your head has to come with you, of course. So, you know, I think changing the helmet may serve better for the football. And then for hockey, I think it might be more of a rules change. You know, maybe make some kind of like targeting call for hockey, perhaps. I mean, there's tons of calls to be made already, but, you know, you got to make the consequences perhaps a little bit steeper for those who are trying to, you know, whether they're not trying to or not, but the guys that are going for those guys and hurting them, you know, the goons out there.
Now, I brought this up. This is going to step a little away from the medical for just 1 second. You're a hockey person, sports person. I brought this up last week, and Russ said he didn't think that that aspect would translate. You just brought up maybe finding a way to make a targeting call for hockey. With targeting, 9 times out of 10, they have to go back, review it frame by frame to see what happened, because it's a play that's so fast, you can't see it from the naked eye and have all the information. In a way, wouldn't that be a little bit of a deterrent, because the upside to hockey is the speed. It is the fast play, and stopping every time someone makes a hit that in the ref's eye is suspect is going to turn this game into a slow play of play for a few minutes, stop. Spend 5 minutes watching the replay, analyzing, trying to make the decision, play, and then risk it happening 5 minutes more. It slows down the pace of the game, and I feel like it would take something away from it. In your opinion, can they make a targeting rule in hockey that wouldn't affect the speed of the game and how the tempo and all that?
Yeah, that is a good question, and it's very player-dependent, too, because, you know, they already stopped the game to look at goals, and that's not as frequent, but it does definitely slow down the game. So if you throw in another rule change like that, it could slow it down a little bit more. But as far as frequency goes, you know, those things don't really happen too much to slow it down a lot. I think as far as player safety goes, it might be worth investigating how that type of rule or action could be taken and implemented in the league. Because, you know, you already have a lot of penalties to call for these things that you could kind of call targeting, like slashing. You're targeting the guy's leg, you're targeting the guy's arm. You know, if it's for the head, you know, we recently just saw, you know, two players in Landeskog. Gabriel Landeskog got suspended for, I believe it was 4 games, for basically checking Tkachuk in the back of the neck.
Yeah.
So that could be kind of your equivalent to a targeting type of thing, because it looked pretty intentional. So that would be one example of where that could be implemented. And I don't think too much time would have to be stopped to look at that, because it was pretty, you know, I guess I'll just say barbaric.
Pretty barbaric. Now, but could it also kind of stand as a deterrent? Because in the way of football, if you get called for targeting, you're gone. You're out of the game. And there's a suspension that follows. In hockey, it could be almost a deterrent, because if they set the parameters for targeting and they go back and review it, is it going to kind of deter guys from thinking they can get away with those cheap hits? Because there's not really a rule in place to, obviously, if you go up behind someone and smack them in the back of the head with a stick, that's pretty clear cut. But if you skate up behind a guy, and since it's a game of, you know, split seconds, you hit that guy into the boards and you hit him in a way that's not really fair, but it's not really against the rules, you're not going to get suspended. You're not going to get in a lot of trouble, and you stay in the game. Whereas if we come up with parameters for targeting and you hit that guy, well, you clearly textbook to what we call targeting, hit this guy, you're out of the game, league review. Would it stand as maybe a little bit of a deterrent for these players that get away with these cheap hits to have to back off a little bit? Because no one wants one of their players, even if it is a enforcer physicality kind of guy, constantly getting tossed out of games, getting suspended, getting fines. Eventually that adds up for a team, and you're more of a detriment than you are an asset.
Yeah, I would like to think so, because, you know, no one likes to have money taken away from them. So these, you know, these players, that's their livelihood. So if you hit them where it hurts in their pockets, I think that'll kind of get their attention to, you know, hopefully, of course, hopefully make them stop doing that. And I don't think the fans will be too upset with this either, because, you know, everyone loves to see the fight, but no one really likes to see the guy get, you know, kind of tomahawked over the back of the neck with a stick. So, I can't speak for everyone, but I think I would like to see that type of thing go away, because you can get some, you know, someone could get seriously hurt. And also, you know, if you want to bring back what Todd Bertuzzi did, and, you know, he and everyone that fell onto this, the guy that he punched afterwards, probably is what really did it. But, you know, things like that, just they can't exist, because that, for one, changed the entire guy's career and life, you want to argue that. So, you know, I think a bigger deterrent or a bigger punishment like that will hopefully keep those things at bay. You know, it doesn't happen a lot, which is a good thing, but it's something that, you know, it can prevent other serious things from happening, no matter how seldom they may be.
Or even, I know it wasn't on a player, but the Weidman hit last year where he just trucked the ref. No suspension, no fine. He said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it. And that was the end of it. Something like that can't stand, because that's, on an NHL player or another hockey player, that's a dirty hit. That's a he laid that guy out, took the stick straight up on him. That's a dirty hit. It's these kind of things that I feel like dirty hits need to be enforced. Every once in a while, it's kind of one way or the other. There's no right answer to it, so you got to kind of live with those. But the Bertuzzi hit, the Landeskog hit, the Weidman hit, those are textbook clear-cut. And I think that they kind of fuel the ability to see how far can I push it before I get caught doing it. And I just think that targeting could be a great, or putting that rule in could be a great incentive to kind of get the game back to where it's still physical, it's still fast-paced, but it's not dirty. Because no one wants to watch a dirty hockey game where guys are just cheap-shotting everyone. Because that's not hockey anymore. That's just fighting on ice. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, a lot of these calls and determinations of the punishment kind of come after, too. Whereas in the NFL, you know, the determination's made, targeting, see you bye, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So if they implement that, too, that, you know, players could miss the game that they're playing in at the moment, too. Because that doesn't really happen unless there's a fight. And, you know, someone's the instigator, fight happens, they send them off. But some for the dirty hit, they don't always kind of address that as far as whether they should continue playing the game that they're in. Within that game, it kind of goes up to the player safety administration above them to determine what happens. So, if you kind of get to the players when it happens, then that might be a good thing as well, because, you know, they don't take away their paycheck, don't take away their time, and they'll be happy people. So if they don't want that to happen, then they got to play by the rules.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's going to do it for us on Armchair Sports Talk. I appreciate D.O. Rowe taking the time.
My pleasure.
Always great. And, yeah, we appreciate you listening, and hope to get your feedback on all this and go from there. This is Armchair Sports Talk. At least one of us went to college.